Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. As Greater New York and the greater world continue to adjust to the reality that Donald Trump will be president of the United States, we will continue to be a place where people can talk and listen to each other, a place where you can express your fear, anger, disbelief, grief, disorientation, reorientation, plans for resisting the worst of what might be coming. But many of you also voted for Trump. And we'll keep giving you airtime, too. In the greater New York area, there were many Trump counties, Staten Island, Suffolk County, not Westchester or Rockland, but most of the other Hudson Valley counties above Rockland voted for Trump, and in above Westchester on that side of the river. And in New Jersey, Morris County, Cape May County, Ocean County, and Sussex County, among others, all Trump-majority counties. So our area is politically diverse, and in a polarized media and a polarized country and with such distrust rising, among the things we'll do here is continue to be a place for diverse voices and for people to hopefully listen as you talk to each other and as we do journalism to hold everybody in power accountable. Today we'll have three separate call-in segments along with our guests. Later this hour, we'll open the phones for Dreamers here legally now under President Obama's DACA program, or other people who may be undocumented immigrants when the head of the New York Immigration Coalition, Steve Choi, comes on. Another one later for Bernie Sanders voters on what you think Bernie and the movement that backed him can do now. And Senator Sanders will be on with us at 11:30. I've been promoting this week that he was scheduled for right now, 10 o'clock, but his schedule changed. And they told us he has to do this at 11:30 now. So Bernie Sanders, 11:30 this morning. And for right now, as we welcome Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel, we invite listeners who voted for Donald Trump to call in and tell us how you think his first days as president-elect are going and what you want him to do now. So our first call-in today, and we'll hear from undocumented immigrants later and Bernie Sanders supporters later and others, 212-433-WNYC if you voted for Donald Trump. I'll mention that many of you who called as Trump supporters during the campaign and said why you were doing so, said you were doing so despite all the things that he said that seemed to reflect hate or bigotry. You know the litany of things. Many of you said he was just being provocative to get elected. Liberals shouldn't take him seriously. Or literally, I should say, don't take him literally, things like that. But now he's appointed Stephen Bannon to be one of his top two advisors. With all the things Bannon has said or seen fit to print as editor of Breitbart News. So if you voted for Trump, how are you processing the Bannon appointment? If you said Trump doesn't really mean it during the campaign, what do you say now? Also, do you want Rudy Giuliani for Secretary of State? That's on the table right now. 212-433-WNYC. If you voted for Donald Trump, it's your turn. 212-433-9692. And Washington Post political reporter Dave Weigel does join us now. He's covering transition developments, including a lot of pushback now to the idea of Rudy Giuliani as Secretary of State. And he has also covered the alt-right or grassroots extreme right quite a bit, so we'll talk about that. Dave, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for being here, and to anyone disappointed that you can't hear Bernie Sanders. Sure, it's good to be here. Good to be here.
You're going to do Bernie, or are you going to do Larry David doing Bernie Sanders?
I think that's what Bernie Sanders himself does sometimes.
Is Rudy Giuliani going to be our next Secretary of State?
He has tipped for that. So my role in this transition reporting is fairly specific. I've covered the alt-right generally, Steve Bannon specifically, for years. I was looking back at some of my old reporting for Slate in 2011, 2012, and I talked to Bannon in ways that all seem revealing now in the way that looking over an old family album can reveal things in 2016. So I'm covering that more than who gets what job. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Giuliani, the Associated Press and our people say that he's lobbying for it. Trump likes him. He did yeoman work for Trump. I mean, he defended – there was one day in the campaign, and this is something that matters very much to Donald Trump. One day in the campaign when everyone else on the Trump team backed out of interviews this is after the Access Hollywood tape, which my colleague David Farenthold reported, Rudy Giuliani went on every Sunday show to defend him. So if that – if you think that's not the number one qualification for State Department, maybe that you have an opinion worth listening to, but I think in Trump's world that matters a lot. The stumbling block might come because there are people in the Senate like Rand Paul who are not inclined and have told me they're not inclined to vote for Giuliani. So that's one conflict that might be coming up soon.
Yeah, let's talk about that one for just a second, because I saw your article. You quoted Rand Paul, who's a libertarian, minimal interventionist on foreign policy, saying he wouldn't vote to confirm Giuliani, or another rumored contender, John Bolton, who's another, for people who don't know Bolton, verbal flame-throwing neocon from the Bush days, known to be very interventionist with respect to how he wants the military used. Is John Bolton under consideration as far as you know, or maybe more importantly, how does this all fit with Trump running on his opposition to the Iraq war, whether he opposed it as early as he said or not, and not wanting to spend billions of dollars on foreign wars rather than use the money here at home?
That's a really good question. So part of this is that Donald Trump was abandoned by a lot of the party apparatus even before he was the nominee. So in a normal, let's say Marco Rubio had won the election, you would have had a lining up of very familiar faces within the Republican Party mainstream, and not much question about ideology, because that ideology would have won the election. With Bolton, I think, same with Giuliani, come to foreign policy with – I think strength prioritized over everything. And there is a way to sell what they're saying as not hawkishness, but a sense that if America gets involved in anything, it should come in with overwhelming force. I think that is how the Bolton and Giuliani approach to this stuff is going to be sold. I think that's resonant with Donald Trump. Remember, he did not oppose the Iraq war from the outset. He wished it went well, and then when it turned the other way, he was against it.
Right.
So it's not clear that he has this ideological commitment to one style of warfare enough. He has a commitment to toughness, and he has a commitment to not being on the wrong side of things.
Right. Well, that could mean more war. I guess we'll have to wait and see. And a lot of the pushback, and I'm not going to go through the list of things very much. People are hearing it all day, I think. Pushback against Giuliani is financial ties that are being revealed now, like to the government of Qatar, which he said should have disqualified Hillary Clinton from being president because of their contribution to the Clinton Foundation, because of its human rights record. But he personally had a contract with them, an anti-Iran government group labeled a terrorist group at the time he represented it, you know, and other things like that. But one other reason that maybe he's not going to get the job is that this rumor didn't come from the Giuliani inner circle. Trump inner circle. It came from Giuliani himself to the Wall Street Journal, something that the Trump inner circle might see as inappropriately self-promotional and not a team player when he does something like that in public. Have you heard that?
I haven't heard much of that. No, I guess I've been focused more on the people that Trump came to trust who were reliable to him when everyone else departed. And I really think that matters more than anything else we might look for in Kremlinology.
Yeah.
That's just the defining characteristic of everything. This is his family members of his family, we're still trying to tease this out, might be in the running for security clearances, which is unusual, but it's because they were highly involved. So in his campaign. So I don't think we need to – it's important to do. It's important to keep track of this. But I think there are almost parallel tracks running within this transition. There are people around Mike Pence who want to create – and I think people around Reince Priebus who want to create a well-running Republican administration. And there are people more loyal to Donald Trump who, as Elliot Cohen writes today, are more interested in whether you backed him or not than anything else. So the loyalty question. This is not a 100% reversal of how Barack Obama approached this in 2008, but at this time in 2008, maybe a couple weeks later, his main primary rival was being brought into the most powerful position in administration, one that was understood correctly as setting her up for running for president herself 8 years later, and most of her staff was allowed to be part of the administration too, even though they had undermined the president. That is not something we're going to see with Donald Trump.
Let's take some phone calls from Trump supporters, and then we'll talk about Steve Bannon. And I have a clip of him from a speech that he gave to a Vatican conference on poverty, of all things, that I want to play and see if you can put it in context. But first, let's take a few calls. Here's Avi in Locust Manor, who I think supports Rudy Giuliani for Secretary of State. Avi, thank you very much for calling us.
Yeah, no, actually, I'm a reluctant Trump supporter. I hate to say this, but I think the man is crazy, but I voted more against Hillary than I did for Trump.
Uh-huh.
But I'll say one thing, had a comment, a guest was saying it was a white lash, like last week.
We played the clip of Van Jones, who said that on CNN, yes.
Oh, yeah, and something like that. I was just voting against the corruption, and I very reluctantly voted for Trump. But here's an example. Trump is, like, all of a sudden becoming cozy with Putin, and Putin's a dictator. And so I have a problem with that. But Giuliani was able to see things as they were. When Arafat came to Lincoln Center, Arafat had him kicked out. Just because all of a sudden now he's a statesman doesn't change the fact that he was a murderer. And I like that clarity that Giuliani had the guts to do something when I'm sure it was considered unpopular.
Avi, thank you very much. Frank, is it Milneck? Frank, you're on WNYC.
Hey, good morning, Brian. How are you today?
I'm okay. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I am a reluctant Trump voter due to our poor options that our political system gave us. I had to vote for Trump because I'm not in favor of World War III. But I did want to point out, how are the Democrats having this PTED, post-traumatic election disorder, excuse me. I mean, this is a democracy that we voted on, and these people can't even handle the results. How could they handle a situation as large as geoengineering, which is happening every day over our heads, Brian?
Very nice getting your geoengineering in there, Frank.
Is this chemtrails? What's he talking about?
Yeah. No, that was a phony call. I don't know if he was a Trump voter or not, or if.
I mean, as phony calls go, that at least is kind of made me think for a second.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of Republicans are saying things like, and he put it creatively if he made it up himself, that Democrats have post-traumatic election disorder. But I think that people also have to understand that many people are not just coming from a partisan standpoint. People who are black or Muslim or Latino or women feel a tangible sense of fear in many cases and things like that, which we'll get into later when we do our immigrant mm-hmm. call-in. Let's talk about Steve Bannon, and then we'll go back to the phones and the alt-right. We had a caller this week, Dave, and I've heard some other progressives say, please don't call it the alt-right. It sounds too friendly, like alt-rock. I see mm-hmm. you wrote an article called What's the Alt-Right? A Primer. So what's the alt-right? And since that's still a new term to many people, where did that term come from?
Well, the term was coined by two people who kind of used it in different ways. There's Paul Gottfried, who is a paleoconservative, sort of a Pat Buchanan conservative academic in Maryland, who said we in 2008 after Barack Obama's election, we need an alternative right because the neoconservative right – represented by George W. Bush, had been discredited and electorally destroyed. The alternative right was more like what Pat Buchanan wanted, a populist right that appeals to nationalism and blue-collar voters and avoids foreign entanglement. The term was kind of shaped again, and I think more influentially, by Richard Spencer, who was a white nationalist. I would say intellectual, that term is loaded. I mean, he's somebody who did a lot of academic study and then walked away from it. But he has become a star of this, and I've known him, I'd say, for 9 years. He originally was involved in kind of local libertarian politics in Virginia, and after 2008 and 2009, used alt-right to characterize this very race-first philosophy. And I've looked back at my own writing and wondered if I was too hesitant in using terms like race and racism. I used it pretty frequently because it's open about it. The belief in the alternative right is there is a what is it an alternative to? It's an alternative to the George Bush style of conservatism in which Republican politics are about lowering taxes, making it easier to start a business, and letting in more immigrants because they'll vote for you if you make life better for them. The alternative to that is basically getting us back to the politics of 1928, where you put restrictions on immigration, where you look for policies that make it easier to live in rural areas, where you protect a fairly traditional white lifestyle. And that is what a sort of conservatism was 90 years ago that was abandoned by conservatives for generations, and that is what has come back. And so Steve Bannon is not – this is the thing. No one wants to be associated with racism of any kind unless they're a David Duke or something. Steve Bannon is not – but has said that Breitbart, under his leadership, was a home for the alt-right. He didn't mean every worst element of that, but he meant that basic philosophy. He meant that a philosophy that looked at the world as a series of threats and looked at a good politics for America as protecting a fortress America from those threats, even if people called you racist or politically incorrect for doing so. And all these things I'm talking about are online. It takes
– sure.
You can click the article you talked about. You can take 5 minutes and read Richard Spencer's work.
Right.
This is something that was not hidden at all during the campaign, very well explained. More so, I'm kind of thinking back to how people like Glenn Beck characterized the views of Obama administration appointees in 2009. And tried to find academic papers from the 60s that maybe explain their thinking. Alt-right folks were very clear about what they thought about the world. It is, and I'd say go back to Pat Buchanan, then go back a little further to the 1920s,
yeah,
when the conservative idea of immigration was don't have any.
And doesn't Glenn Beck, however, now say Steve Bannon is dangerous?
He does now. There's a kind of a long-running feud between them, and for a while it was Bannon was less of a relevant figure. Now Beck's less of a relevant figure. I was looking back at my own work in 2011. Andrew Breitbart, who had hired Steve Bannon to expand Breitbart News, was ranting about how Glenn Beck was exploiting Breitbart's own content and making it look crazy. So Glenn Beck, at his I'll say his worst, was fanning these theories that the Obama administration was on the cusp of creating FEMA camps and using socialist policies to destroy what was good about America. He's faded, and I think it's hard to know when he's being serious because he's had a couple of different turns of heart.
Yeah.
Changes of heart to turns of phrase.
So
where he looks back at what he did, but no, it was Glenn Beck basically had mainstream conservative views, but then added to that this threat that was going to put us all in camps. The alt-right never said these people are going to put us in camps. They said the real policies we have now are turning us into France, where there are going to be race riots and where white people are going to be discriminated against. And so they had a nightmare vision that was much more tangible. That's what Beck is arguing against now from a pretty weak position.
Dave Weigel from The Washington Post, our guest. And I want to play a clip of Steve Bannon. Yesterday, BuzzFeed published a transcript of a speech that Bannon gave at a Vatican conference on poverty 2 years ago. I don't know if you've seen this, but he denounced two types of capitalism that he said the Republicans enable today. Ayn Rand capitalism, which is too libertarian and reduces human beings to commodities, and crony capitalism, which enables big corporations over entrepreneurs, a kind of state capitalism, U.S. style. And I thought that could have been Bernie Sanders saying all that. Bannon also came out of Goldman Sachs, as you know, and he hates Wall Street and thinks more leaders there should have been prosecuted for the financial crisis. I'm going to ask Bernie Sanders about this next hour. But here's Bannon to a Vatican conference on poverty. This is 50 seconds, right after he says he finds Ayn Rand capitalism disturbing.
And look, I'm a big believer in a lot of libertarianism. I have many, many friends, and it's a very big part of the conservative movement, whether it's the UKIP movement in England, it's many of the underpinnings of the populist movement throughout Europe, and particularly in the United States. However, that form of capitalism is quite different when you really look at it to the what I call the enlightened capitalism of the Judeo-Christian West. It is a capitalism that really looks to make people commodities and to objectify people and to use them as really almost as many of the precepts of Marx. And that is a form of capitalism, particularly to a younger generation, that they're really finding quite attractive. And if they don't see another alternative, it is going to be an alternative that they gravitate to under this kind of rubric of personal freedom.
Steve Bannon speaking to a Vatican poverty conference in 2014. Dave, did you know about that speech? And is that consistent with what Bannon usually says, that free market capitalism, and remember, Paul Ryan calls himself an Ayn Rand disciple and used to hand out copies of her books as a younger congressman. But Bannon says that kind of free market capitalism commodifies human beings.
No, that is what Steve Bannon's always said. Again, this is not somebody who's ever hid what he believes. He hosted a radio show for 5 years where the news always came from who they were interviewing, but the worldview is basically what he said there. He's given a chance to explain it. This is not something somebody had to ask a Russian to hack and find. This was on the internet,
right,
and BuzzFeed just had the insight to pull it out.
Right.
It's very clear. And the feud between Ryan and Breitbart, again, it's what was kind of a one-sided feud, but now is a lot more relevant. Brandon was very clear that he thought the Ryan version of conservatism was soft and hurtful to working people. The site went very hard on Ryan's primary opponent, who lost in a landslide this year. But before that, he made fun of basically Ryan linking Catholic social welfare talk to his economics. And I think Bannon had a political point here, which is that it's kind of forgotten that Paul Ryan ran for vice president in 2012. He's from Wisconsin. He lost Wisconsin badly on this ticket with Mitt Romney.
Yeah, and
we
Trump
had recent
won.
Evidence that, and Trump won it. So we had evidence. Imagine you're Steve Bannon. Imagine you've been saying this, and you've said Paul Ryan's views are what's killing the Republican Party. Imagine you then join a presidential campaign and prove that right by winning a state that Ryan couldn't win. He doesn't have much patience for Ryan talking about what the Republican Party actually stands for. His criticism of Ryan, that this was a wimpy and kind of exclusionary version of conservatism that could never win a majority, from his perspective, has been totally validated. But to see what he thinks was validated, you just kind of go back to what he said for 5 years.
So before we go back to some Trump voter callers, does that suggest any economic policy that we might see from Trump? You made very clear in your description of the alt-right how much they want to limit immigration, how much they feel that white culture, whatever that is under threat. Because, you know, mostly we're hearing about that with respect to Bannon. Mostly we're hearing about big tax cuts for the rich from Trump, of which Ayn Rand would heartily approve. So does what we know about Bannon and his influence on Trump suggest any kind of progressive, if that's the right word, economic policy?
Well, yeah, you have to look really to what the UK Independence Party favors. This is the nice thing about covering the alt-right, is that there are existing European political parties that these guys have held up as models for a very long time.
That's the pro-Brexit party, right?
The pro-Brexit party, the National Front. What Bannon liked about those parties from a political standpoint is that they were capturing working-class voters who had always in France voted for the socialists or communists, in Britain voted for the Labour Party. And they were capturing those kinds of voters because they felt foreign trade had taken their jobs away and immigration was taking what jobs were left. And those parties were very protectionist. They were very into infrastructure spending. They're not tax cuts will fix everything. This is the oddity of the Trump campaign, is that he has a coherent nationalist economic philosophy, which I think when you hear them talking about infrastructure bills, that is where his mind is at. It's twinned, however, with this sort of supply side economics he got from people like Art Laffer and Steve Moore, people who advised him, which is not really what those parties believe. They think you basically kind of create a fortress around the country and you take it from there. You might see, because of who runs the Congress, less energy for the protectionism, more for the cuts. But this is the coalition he's built. His strongest performances were in Appalachia, where people could really – they couldn't benefit less from tax cuts to people making more than $200,000 a year or corporate tax cuts. And it's kind of up to Trump whether he wants to prioritize the protectionism over that, because everyone else in the Republican Party is going to be saying just cut the taxes and everything takes care of it.
Really interesting. Michael in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Sure. Thanks, Brian. I just want to say I'm a huge fan, and it's been really great listening to you over the campaign.
Thank you.
I originally was a Rubio supporter, and it was kind of a hard shift for me to to vote for Trump. And I think, kind of like the first caller said, it was more of a vote against Hillary than for Trump. But I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of Bannon, really not. But the other picks I'm actually kind of happy with. You know, I like Reince Priebus, and I think Giuliani would probably be pretty good. And, you know, I like Steve Moore. I don't know if he's going to be actually part of the administration.
Steve Moore, yeah. More from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, free market economics wing.
Yes. Yeah, I actually was at a conference where he spoke. He's really actually, I think, quite good. Like I was telling the screener, I was actually kind of comforted to see how he spoke with the president, and his acceptance speech I thought was very conciliatory and gracious.
Trump.
Like I said, I didn't like the way he originally reacted to the protesters, but I think he kind of backtracked on that in a positive sense, saying, you know, I understand people are upset, but, you know, I think it's time to kind of, get together. So if he kind of stays on that, track, I'm kind of optimistic.
And how much does the Bannon pick, because of what Dave was just describing, with respect to views of the alt-right that he kind of channels or enables, worry you about what kind of country this is going to be?
I mean, it is a concern, but I don't think that's why he chose Bannon. I don't think that's why he chose him. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. And I don't think that's the uh-huh. reason that he, and he's kind of rebuffed these, alt-right supporters when they do come out publicly for him. It is troubling, I agree. But I think these are people who are here, from before. He didn't create these people, and yes, he may have used them to get into the position where he's in, but I don't think that's what he's trying to push.
Michael, thank you very much. What do you think about that, Dave Weigel, from your reporting? Is that not why he appointed Steve Bannon? Did he appoint Steve Bannon despite the alt-right connection? And do mm-hmm. you see Trump becoming serious about pushing back against those people if they, we know they're feeling empowered. We know there are incidents taking place around the country of swastikas being drawn on things and other stuff. What can you read?
Well, it depends which part of the outright you're talking about. I think Trump is perfectly happy to denounce out-and-out racism once it becomes impossible to ignore. He, in his career, has been more comfortable, like Rudy Giuliani's been more comfortable, taking the side of police, for example, against people accused of crimes, even if those people are later found to be innocent. So the part of Breitbart that I think people find disturbing, but you can't easily accuse of racism, is the coverage of crimes committed by immigrants, or rumors of crimes committed by immigrants, rumors of rape statistics in European countries, that sort of stuff. I think it's not, Trump has no problem with that sort of coverage or that sort of divide and conquer view of the world. And I think, getting back to how Bannon works as a political operative, I think one thing Trump liked about him was that he never backs down. This is the way Trump thinks is the way Bannon thinks. It was Bannon really was responsible. For example, when Trump was being accused by very credible seeming women of sexual assault and general creepy behavior, it was Bannon's idea to gather women who'd accuse Bill Clinton of affairs and give them a press conference, because Bannon had this understanding, as he told Bloomberg last year, that young voters had no idea about any of that stuff. Two, that the media couldn't resist covering. And then I think the media, not just Breitbart, the larger, every network went live with that, had a split screen of that press conference while Hillary Clinton was walking in.
Right.
So Bannon has this kind of very astute idea of how to sow chaos, how the media works. Right. And it wasn't apparent in his whole career.
And that's why his position is chief strategist.
No, exactly. It's something – there's a lot of credible reporting that he wanted him as chief of staff, which would have been a gigantic leap, something that – based on Bannon's ability to run a large but not enormous news organization and then be in a campaign it wasn't clear he was perfect for that job. But for chief strategist, I mean, look at who else has had that job in the past. It's people like John Podesta. It's people like Karl Rove, who have a view of how to not just run the White House, but keep the president politically viable for re-election and for passage of bills in Congress. And the Bannon view of how to keep something politically viable is to accentuate the threats to the threats to the country and the threats to your way of life. Not to say, here's how we come together. It's to say, here's who you should be afraid of.
Roger in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Brian. I love your show. I've listened for years.
Thank you.
I'm calling. I started to say something to your screener before, but I think I changed my voice. Basically, I'm a Sephardic Jew from Egypt, and I came here a long time ago, and I mostly voted Democrats most of my life, except that what I've watched now is the anti-Semitism growing on the left and the Democratic side, and that was really the push for me to vote for Trump. So in general, I think Trump, you know, goes on a far right to some degree, but by and large, he's much more sane, much more honest than he's made out to be. And the fear-mongering among the left and my Democratic friends, I live in Brooklyn Heights, and that is a bastion of liberal thinking, and I've lost a few friends on that account. But and my son won't talk to me. But that situation being said, I find that the Democrats and the left in general have been very disingenuous, very kind of fascist in their silence of people who basically disagree with them. And you see that in the streets, and you see that in universities, and you see that everywhere. So I like the way Trump is going with his pick of Bannon. I don't think Bannon's an anti-Semite.
You know that the Anti-Defamation League protested the appointment of Bannon.
That is correct. I know that. I'm familiar with that. And again, they have their point of view, and I don't disagree with some of their, you know, with some of their fears. But by and large, the Zionist Organization of America, you know, didn't think he was that horrible. So, you know, when the Democrats basically demonized Jews for having their wanting to have their own nation state in Israel, surrounded by thousands of millions of people who want to destroy them.
And of course, to be fair, there's almost no Democrat who would. To be fair, there's almost no Democrat who would say that they don't support the right of the Jews to have the state of Israel as a Jewish state. They object to settlements. They object to Netanyahu talking about maybe no two-party, two-state solution anymore.
That may be true, Brian. But what happens is that who they pick right now, who they're working with, who's coming into the fold, the Democratic fold, are basically a lot of anti-Israel leftists. And the left in general has picked a side against Jewish self-determination. And I feel that very strongly. Again, I was born in Egypt. I've seen anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I know an anti-Semite when I see one. And Bannon is not one. And definitely Trump is not one.
Roger, thank you very much. So after that one, we were going to be out of time. But since we have Omar from Coney Island calling as a black Muslim for Trump, let's give him a couple of minutes. Omar, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi there. How are you doing now? I'm going to tell you exactly what's going on here. First of all, two reasons I voted for Trump. Number one, and this is very important for people to know, Elijah Wallace Muhammad and Malcolm X, who is basically channeling Elijah Wallace Muhammad, stated very succinctly, you can trust the white supremacist. You cannot trust the white liberal. The white liberal talks out of both sides of their mouth, and they will stab you in the back.
But can you...
Let me finish.
Go ahead.
But the white supremacist, you know exactly where he stands, and you can, and the black people can deal with him accordingly. Both Elijah Wallace Muhammad and Malcolm X met quite regularly with the white supremacists of their time. That's number one. Number two, the immigration problem. You go down, I'm in Coney Island here. You go down Brighton Beach Avenue. You go down Coney Island Avenue. There's a lot of businesses there. They refuse to hire African-American youth. They will only hire Mexicans or whatever ilk there is, but they refuse to hire African-American youth. So you wonder why there's problems of drugs and unemployment in the African-American community? That is what it is. Those are the two reasons why I supported Trump. Now, you had a comment.
Oh, no, that's okay, and I'm going to leave it there for time. But, Omar, thank you. very much and call us again. Well, Dave Weigel, we are out of time, but interesting coalition.
It is. I just say that the Democrats' position on Israel seems to be sync up pretty well with the Labor Party in Israel and the peace movement in Israel. And they also just went through a primary where a Jewish candidate got 14 million votes. So I take all that with
Bernie Sanders
as much with a Lot's wife amount of salt, I think. And I think a lot of what the second caller was discussing in terms of meetings with white supremacists was a lot of PR in the 1960s more than something coherent. But no, this is what we have to deal with now. So, geotagging in the skies. Let's go for it.
A lot. You remember the first the earlier caller. A Lot's wife amount of salt. I like that. I think that's the first time that expression has ever gotten said on the show. And speaking of the candidate who is Jewish and got 14 million votes, he will be here in an hour. Bernie Sanders will be our guest at 11:30. For now, we thank Dave Weigel, national politics correspondent for The Washington Post. Dave, keep coming on. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.